We'll call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is Wednesday, February 13th, 2013. Has anyone reviewed the minutes? We have two sets to approve.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh moves the minutes of February 6th, 2013, and February 12th, 2013. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Moline's House File 330. Members, it's my intention to hear this bill and lay this over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Moline, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 330 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Please go ahead, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this is the bill that I had briefly mentioned yesterday. And I have Judge Stauber here from the Court of Appeals who's going to make some comments after I'm done presenting my bill. The bill simply makes changes to the compensation for only Court of Appeals judges. Paragraph B allows for any judge of the Court of Appeals whose permanent place of residence is more than 50 miles from the judge's chambers here in St. Paul be allowed a housing allowance as well as mileage reimbursement for travel from their permanent place of residence to their chambers in St. Paul. Current law only allows for 2 years of housing and mileage reimbursement, and then Greater Minnesota judges are expected to either relocate to the Twin Cities metro area or pay for housing close to their chambers out of their own pocket. The purpose of my bill is to fairly compensate judges from Greater Minnesota who serve on the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And just a little historical information, the Court of Appeals is currently composed of 19 judges, and by law, there must be one judge appointed from each of Minnesota's 8 congressional districts, and the other 11 judges on the Court of Appeals are at-large appointments. And the historical purpose of requiring one judge from each congressional district was to ensure statewide representation on the Minnesota Court of Appeals, since, of course, they serve the entire state. At this point in time, I believe there are only 4 judges on the Court of Appeals who live more than 50 miles from St. Paul. 2 of these judges are still in the 2-year grace period for housing and mileage, and the other 2 are paying out of pocket for housing expenses near their chambers in St. Paul. And, you know, at this time, I'll turn it over to Judge Stauber, who, when I first introduced this bill last session, was a constituent of mine, and unfortunately, I lost him in redistricting. But he is the judge on the Court of Appeals who represents Minnesota's 8th Congressional District. He lives about 20 miles north of Duluth. And so he's here to, provide his testimony on the importance of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and then go ahead.
Madam Chair, Larry Stauber, Jr., Grand Lake Township, up in St. Louis County, north of Duluth. I'm here speaking on my own behalf. I'm not speaking as a part of the judiciary. They've made it very clear that, you know, I'm on my own here, and that's fine. I don't know what the judiciary would say about this, but I've talked to Ms. Moline, Representative Moline, several times about this issue. I've been on this court going on 5 years. I received the reimbursement for 2. The last 31 months, I pay for my own apartment down here, and I pay for my own mileage back and forth to Grand Lake Township, which is 154.6 miles each way. So I've always thought, and historically, we were supposed to move to the Twin Cities once you came on the Court of Appeals, and that now, you know, that doesn't happen. There's technology. I could probably work out of my house 4 days a week if I wanted to, or 5, but being at the Court of Appeals, there's outreach, there's collegiality, there's meeting with the other judges, and there's the convenience of being here to have your clerks with you and your JAAs with you and all that kind of stuff that you don't have if you stayed at home. So I choose to come down here, and I knew when I took this job that there was a 2-year time limit. But as I got down here, I thought, you know, it's not really fair anymore. And Representative Moline is a little bit wrong. There are 3 of us on the court right now that live significantly further away. We have one out of Moorhead, one out of Walker now, and then I'm out of north of Duluth. And Judge Werke lives, there's a fourth. Who's our fourth? Judge Werke lives in Owatonna. Oh, and John Rodenberg lives in New Ulm. So Governor Dayton has done a very, very good job of expanding the Court of Appeals representation to greater Minnesota. And I have to say that I'm very happy because, we all like people from different parts of the state. So I'm here speaking on my own. The Chief Justice represents the court. Jeff Shorba represents the court. They'll talk to you about their issues with this. But the group that I represent would like you to consider allowing us to have some compensation for our travel and housing expenses. And with that, I'll close.
Questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And would the am I understanding that the budget for the mileage and for the housing would come out of the court's budget, or are you asking us to add that on to your budget?
So I have nothing to do with budgets.
Yep.
Where the money comes from, that's far beyond my pay grade. Whether you take it out of the existing court budget or you allocate something for it, that's your call.
Representative Moline, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Scott, there's no appropriation attached with my bill. The idea would be that it would come out of the court's budget. I don't know if they would need an additional appropriation or not in order to cover the expenses. I'm in the process of having a fiscal note prepared. Like I said, right now there are only four judges. Right now there are only two judges that would be included, but 2 years from now there would be four judges that would be included. So it's a relatively small number, but I am in the process of having a fiscal note prepared.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam.
Sorry, Representative Scott has a follow-up.
Oh, no, I just had more of a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, with the foreclosed properties around here, maybe you guys could find a triplex or a fourplex that's in foreclosure. Just have your department buy it, and that can be the housing for the appeals court fourplex.
You make that call. I'd love to live with some of the guys that I work with because they're great guys, and I think, if we each had a bedroom apiece, that'd be super.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moline, what do legislators live more than 50 miles away get reimbursed for? What amount per month? Is it $1,000 like you have in here?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. The House sets those amounts. We have a certain amount that we can spend within the two-year biennium. I think it's around, $21,000 right now, which ends up being $900 a month max if you do a 12-month lease. And you can't exceed $1,200 a month. So, for example, if you do a six-month lease, you could do one for $1,200 a month. But if you're going to do two 12-month leases within a biennium, it amounts to being about $900 a month.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Moline, if we set this rule for ourselves through House rules and the Senate does their own rules, why can't the judiciary... But why isn't this more appropriate in front of the Judicial Council or something?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. There's flexibility with this bill. We could discuss whether or not we want to allow the judiciary to set the amount that they do per month. I think the issue that we're running into is because of budget cuts over the last several years, the judiciary hasn't taken it upon themselves to offer to provide housing for the Greater Minnesota Court of Appeals judges. And so this legislation was brought forth just to provide fairness for our judges that are coming from Greater Minnesota. That's not to say that the judiciary couldn't do this on their own. That would be nice if they did, but they haven't thus far. And, frankly, there are judges having to pay out of pocket right now for a lot of expenses that legislators aren't asked to do. When we represent Greater Minnesota.
Madam Chair, thank you. And last question, is Judge Werke going to testify on this today?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. No, Judge Werke was unable to make it today.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, normally as the Chair is aware, I usually like to give a little bit of trouble to judges on pay and vacation time whenever they come in front of me, but Judge Werke ruled in my favor on my last appeal in October, so we're square for this year.
Question from members. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. I did hear Mr. Stauber say that he understood that when he entered into this, that, you know, he understood what, I mean, all of the judges, I expect, understand that when they take the job, that these are the conditions under which they take the job. And I don't know what Court of Appeals judges are paid, but we learned yesterday that that the district court judges are paid $129,000 a year, and then after you figure in the rest of their expenses, total compensation is somewhere in the area of $172,000 a year, I believe. So do all the judges understand that when they take the job? And then the other part would be, are there problems recruiting judges and getting good judges to take the positions?
Judge Stauber.
Madam Chair, Representative. You know, I don't know about the last part of recruitment, but I do know that down in the Twin Cities here, there are probably far more applicants for these vacancies than there are up north. And I don't remember the number. Mr. Holtquist probably could, but the number that applied for my position, but it wasn't a tremendous number. So that's, I guess that's the answer to your question. We'd like to have really good people apply for these jobs, but that's one of the considerations they have to make. Not only do you leave your families, you know, my wife is in Duluth 5 days a week, and some of the judges have younger children, like Judge Kirk. He leaves his wife and his child up in Moorhead. But, yes, bottom line is we do know. Now, if you want to know how much I make, I think I make about $137,000 or $38,000 a year, which is about $8,000 or $9,000 more than a district court judge. And if you want to know how much I spend on housing and transportation, you deduct that, and I make significantly less than a district court judge in my district. Anything else?
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if the state court administrator has any thoughts on this bill.
Representative Drazkowski, I don't think he's here, and I think he gave some insight yesterday.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? Representative Lesch.
One more by way of comment, Madam Chair. Many of us who've served here for a while have had fellow legislators make it to Congress, and a few of them, of course, I ribbed them about the outrageous congressional salary. I don't know if they're up to $170,000 a year or something like that now. But they say, yeah, good luck. Try to maintain a household in two areas, and you're not even breaking even, and it's kind of rough. So I have some sympathy for Judge Stauber's statements. Maintaining those households in two different areas and having double the housewares and having to cook for yourself and then, of course, having to eat out from time to time, it gets difficult. So I see where he's coming from. That's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm just wondering, under this law, would housing expense reimbursement be provided to a judge who lived in the Twin Cities area and when appointed to the court and later moved outside?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. That certainly is not the intent of this legislation, although it's a good question to ask because I, you know, wondered that myself, so we might need to fine-tune it in order to avoid that. It does say their permanent place of residence, so, you know, the idea is that they have a permanent place of residence and then they're appointed to the Court of Appeals or elected to the Court of Appeals and that they're chambered more than 50 miles away from their permanent place of residence. It certainly isn't intended to cover people who would be appointed and then decide that they want to move to Bemidji. So that is not the intent of the legislation.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, the chair lays over House File 330 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Thank you for coming. Next, we have the budget overview from the Board of Public Defense. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense.
Excuse me just a minute. We're going to get you some more chairs so you can get your folks up there.
With me today, excuse me, is Chris Kohler, who is a Chief Public Defender in the 9th Judicial District, Northwestern Minnesota, and Bill Ward, who is our Chief in the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County. Madam Chair, what I'd like to do with your indulgence is to talk a little bit about the kind of the general budget situation. I know we had the overview last month, so I don't want to go over a lot of what we covered last month. Have our two chiefs here talk about specifics in terms of what they're dealing with in each of their districts as it relates to some of the issues that we have identified in your handout, and then talk about the budget request. So with your indulgence, we'll go ahead and start.
Go ahead.
So, Madam Chair and members, as we talked about last month, is the Board of Public Defense is the largest user of our state court system. We handle about 150,000 cases a year and handle all the mandated or most of the mandated cases in every courthouse in Minnesota. On page 3 of your handout, you can see the two court cases that deal with those two issues, or that I should say with that issue in terms of the mandated or the inability of public defenders to refuse cases. The annual budget is roughly $67 million a year. On page 4, you can see how that is split out by our three programs. And on page 5 of your handout, you can see roughly almost 90% of the budget is personnel.
I'm going to take you back because we have a number of new members on the committee. So if you could actually talk about in the previous graph on page 4, if you could tell folks what the AS stands for.
Madam Chair, is the district, the 90% or 90.5% is district public defense. Those are what you think of as the trial court. Those are your assistant public defenders and staff who are in the 87 counties. The appellate office is, again, as it says, it handles all of the appellate work, the post-conviction work, the parole revocations that come, and the ASO is our administrative services office, which is basically myself, John Stewart, three other people, and then our 5 tech staff. So those are the 10 people that run the organization, if you will. Madam Chair, on getting comfortable here a little bit, on slide number 7, we talked a little bit about the Legislative Auditor's Report from 2010. In the Legislative Auditor's Report, they found that high public defender workloads have created significant challenges for Minnesota's criminal justice system. The result is we have public defenders spending limited time with clients, difficulty preparing cases, and scheduling problems that hinder the efficient operation of the criminal courts. If you turn to page 8 of your document, you can see, according to state and national standards, we should be spending somewhere around 4 hours on effective representation for clients in misdemeanor cases. When the legislative auditor went out, they saw that basically public defenders were spending roughly 10 minutes per case, introducing themselves, getting a feel for the client, finding out what exactly the client's story was, reading the police report, basically meeting him in the hallway, and then trying to arrange some kind of plea agreement or, in some case, some other decision that's made. Why is that important? Obviously, it's important for the smooth operation of the court. The other reason it's important, obviously, is just in the interest of justice and having somebody represent you and putting the time in. But also what we have found is the number one issue that people have related to public defender services, they want to be listened to. They want somebody to listen to their story, and they want somebody to acknowledge that, yeah, that they've got a fair shake and that they had the time. And it is the one thing that we have found over the years where people are satisfied with the outcome, if you will. if they've had their day in court, if you will, if they've had somebody that's had the time to listen to their story, ask questions, find out about them, they're much more likely to be content with the outcome, maybe not happy with the outcome, and frankly, much less likely to come back into court on some other charge. On page 9, you can see where we are in general. Right now, we are operating at about 58% of state and national standards when it comes to our lawyer staff. So if theoretically under those state and national standards, we should have 100 lawyers doing this work, we have 58.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carr, where did those state and national standards come from? Who decided them and how did they arrive at?
Sure.
Madam
Chair and Representative Lesh, those are ABA standards nationally, and they were first developed in the 1970s, and I believe it was in the late 90s when they were reestablished by the ABA. The legislature also funded a caseload study for public defense specific to Minnesota that came up with those standards. And if you look across the country, those are pretty, it varies somewhat state to state, but they're all within that range. Madam Chair, again, in regard to support staff, if you can see on page 10, we're operating right now with roughly 59% of the staff that we should have, by again, recommended by those same state and national standards. It works out to be roughly one attorney for every 400 cases, one investigator for every roughly 3,500 cases, one paralegal for roughly every 5,700 cases. Now again, a number of those cases, a lot of the misdemeanor cases don't involve investigators and paralegals. But there are a number of cases, frankly, that probably should, that don't, because we simply don't have the time for them.
Mr. Kyer, do you have a breakdown of what percentage or what the number of cases are felony cases versus misdemeanor cases, or could you get that?
Madam Chair, I do. But I can. Do you want it right now, or you want to wait till the end?
Well, whenever.
It takes me a little time to maneuver, but.
You just give that information to us whenever you get to it.
Sure.
I'm fine with that. But please go ahead, Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair, on page 13, again, why is this important? You have a quote there from Judge Rodenberg, who was a district court judge, who Judge Stauber mentioned is now on the Court of Appeals, of the wait time that not only he as a judge has, but all of the people involved in the court have when public defenders aren't available. In 2010, the Minnesota Judicial Workload Assessment Final Report again identified public defenders, or I should say the lack of public defenders, as a reason why they're having trouble in terms of the operation of the court. If you look at page 14 in your handout, the other thing we're starting to see is an increase in the number of guilty plea cases that our appellate office is dealing with. If you can see from 2008 to 2012 and again to 2013, that number is nearly doubled. The only conclusion we can come to right now, and the state public defender actually took a look at a random sampling of these cases to try to find out what was going on here. The only thing that we can make out of this is that people are unhappy with their guilty plea, think that they got rushed into it, again, going back to that 10 minutes per case, and now want to withdraw that guilty plea and start again. And this has been a dramatic increase, as you can see, and has been a terrible workload for the appellate office in terms of the work that they do. As you can see, when you look at the tried cases, those are the direct appeals. That number stayed relatively constant during that same time period. What it also means is right now, if you look at page 15 in your handout, there's just less than half of the counties in the state, and I think you've probably seen this chart before, where we're not at first appearances. There are some places that we shouldn't be at first appearances because there's no prosecutor there in order to get those cases resolved. There are some places that the caseload doesn't warrant that. But there are a lot of places that it does. There are all of places where we're not there to make bail arguments or our folks aren't there to make bail arguments. That's not a well-functioning judicial system. Madam Chair, beginning on page 17, we talk about the specific issues, and I
We're going to stop you for a minute. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I just have one question for you. We're talking about not having a public defender at their first appearance. Isn't that their first appearance? Isn't that where they turn in their paperwork to the judge to get the public defender?
Mr. Kai?
Madam Chair, if I will.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes,
state your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Christine Kohler. I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 9th Judicial District.
So then at the, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
So at their first appearance, they would not have a public defender. The judge would look at the paperwork and decide whether to assign one at that point.
Correct, if they're eligible.
Yeah, so there would never be...
Please go through the chair. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, so then there would never, should never be a public defender at their first appearance.
Ms. Kohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, the rule that governs the first appearances has the advisory performed by the court, not by the public defender. However, there is case law out there that requires a public defender to be at that court appearance. So the rule and the case law are in conflict right now.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I also comment as well?
State your name for the record.
I will. William Ward. I'm the Chief Public Defender for the 4th Judicial District. Having a public defender at the first appearance is incredibly important for the system to move more efficiently and more fairly to everyone. Having the lawyer there advises the client as to why they're there as well, and those conversations happening sooner rather than later helps develop trust between the lawyer and the client, and there's less court appearances than that should happen as a result of that.
Who would like to answer the question then of if bail is set at the first hearing without the public defender present and the defendant is not capable of making the bail that was set, does the client have any recourse then if there is no public defender present?
Madam Chair, I can answer that question.
Ms. Kohler, go ahead.
At the subsequent court appearance, there would be the opportunity to argue for bail again if the client was unrepresented at the first appearance. However, there is a conundrum that happens when there is a public defender present at the first appearance handling a great number of cases. They don't have the time or the resources or the paperwork to make an adequate bail argument. And when they have more time for that subsequent hearing to make that bail argument, they are being told, no, you had your chance to make that argument at the first hearing.
All right. Please continue, Mr. Kai.
Madam Chair, beginning on page 17 is... some of the more specific issues related to not only caseloads, but what we talk about in workloads. Again, the most immediate cause of the high public defender workloads were staffing cuts that we sustained in 2008 and 2009. During that time period, we lost roughly 18% of our attorney staff. And I guess at this point, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Kohler and to Mr. Ward to talk about kind of the workload issues and those specific issues, if you will.
Ms. Kohler, would you like to go first?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I am here to describe a little bit to you about what it's like to be a public defender in rural Minnesota. As I said, I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 9th Judicial District. That would be the 17 Northwest counties. My district starts in Brainerd and goes north to Canada and west to North Dakota. It's over 25,000 square miles. I have 5 offices, and the rest of the counties are covered by part-time lawyers. I have roughly 20 full-time lawyers and 21 part-time lawyers. As a result of both geography and staffing cuts, it's not unusual for lawyers in my district to drive 60 to 70 miles to get to a court appearance, and that's one way. So it'd be 120 to 140 miles round trip just to cover court. In some conflict cases, it's 120 miles one way. I cover conflict cases in International Falls from Grand Rapids. That's a 240-mile round trip to cover one case. Let me remind you that the roads in northwestern Minnesota half the year are remote, and we suffer winter driving conditions. Investigators and dispositional advisors travel even more. When the legislative auditor looked at our organization, one of the issues that was identified was the issue of supervision. How do you as a manager supervise lawyers that are making their court appearances 120 miles from where you are and handle a caseload in the office that you are representing? For example, Steve Moeller is an attorney who is in my Thief River Falls office. He regularly covers Roseau, which is 64 miles away. If he is sick, and we need to cover that case, I could potentially send somebody else from that office. Or one of the things we're asking for in our budget is money to cover technology. I could electronically transmit the file to the public defender, Steve Hughlin, in Roseau County, and he could cover the case. Right now, we don't have the electronic case system to handle that, and the paper file would never make it there. Mr. Kier addressed the issue of clients feeling unsatisfied when their lawyer doesn't get to see them because they're housed 120 miles away. A lot of our clients don't have cars. A lot of our clients don't have access to long distance. And the only time they see their lawyer is when their lawyer drives that 120 miles to make the court appearance. They feel unsatisfied. When I testified in front of the Supreme Court several years ago for the $75 addition to the lawyer registration fee, Justice Anderson asked me why I thought there were so many more cases of ineffective assistance of counsel being raised. And I believe it's because of that reason. We don't have the client contact, and we have to provide the coverage from that far away. I want to end with a fascinating analogy, which will put this issue into perspective for you. Hillary Clinton just received a lot of credit for the amount of miles she flew and the amount of visits she took during her tenure as Secretary of State. She logged 956,000 air miles during her four-year tenure. It's 238,000 miles to the moon. She went to the moon and back twice. During the last four fiscal years, my staff drove 934,000 miles to cover court appearances in Greater Minnesota. Essentially, my staff drove to the moon and back twice to cover the necessary court appearances.
Mr. Ward, did you want to go
ahead? Sure. Again, Madam Chair, William Ward. I'm the Chief Public Defender for Hennepin County, which is the 4th Judicial District. Prior to that time, I spent two terms as the Chief Public Defender for the 10th Judicial District. The eight counties surrounding the Twin Cities in the north, the south, and the west, I guess it is, north, east, and west. To put it in perspective, I mean, our jobs as chief, as administrators, is making sure that we get the best people we can get in to represent folks who are charged with crimes, the indigent accused in the state. You want that, we want that. And, you know, the idea to hire good folks and to retain them with the pay that they get and the stressors that they have is something that's becoming more of a challenge every single year. I started this practice 26 years ago, and I'm telling you the change in doing this work has been a phenomenally difficult one on a daily level. I know that all of you hear about mentally ill either patients or clients or issues that happen in the state every day. You can imagine the challenges that our lawyers have in dealing with these clients who are they're faced with being accused of a crime. This is not anecdotal evidence. The sheriffs have talked about this, either in the public or I'm sure in these halls, about they're housing more and more mentally ill clients that they have to deal with as far as medication issues, housing issues, safety for the jailers, safety for their staff. Those are our clients. More than 33% or 40% is the number that you hear. Some would give you higher numbers of the folks that we have to deal with. So to put it into perspective, our job is to resolve these cases to the best of our ability. We're doing it in a system that is incredibly fast. It's too fast, in my opinion, and yet we're supposed to establish a trusting relationship with clients who are suffering from mental illness. That's what our lawyers and our staff are faced with on a daily basis. More than the effect of this is more than I've seen in my entire career. Correspondingly, we have a number of veterans who have returned back from various wars over the last decade, and those folks are also suffering from some mental illness issues. And as a body, we've made a decision to help them in how we resolve those cases and looking at sentencing issues. So just as in mental health area, we've developed courts and some sort of system to help the best we can, which takes resources. We've done the same thing for veterans court. We have a veterans court in Hennepin County that takes up a tremendous amount of resource from the staff to deal with and understand these issues so we are adequately, more than adequately, representing our clients. Chemical dependency issues. I don't talk about meth and other things that we've been dealing with in this state for so many years. To put it in perspective, in Chicago, where I practiced for 14 years, I never, ever had a single meth case in 14 years. As a chief in the 10th, I was just bombarded with those constantly. And we continue to deal with meth, cocaine, heroin issues, prescription drug issues, and we're trying to figure out how to best deal with those clients in corresponding numbers that are worse than I've ever seen. all of you know, and many of you are responsible to, and in a very positive way, I'm sure, criminal penalties have changed so much over the past 10 years, 20 years in this state, where our lawyers have to be understand and be equipped to deal with these cases on a daily basis, understand the, not just the consequences, but collateral consequences. The length of prison time is increased dramatically, and that changes the way we approach our cases if people are going to prison for boatloads of time. I used the word collateral earlier. For example, the old days, 3 years ago, if someone had immigration issues, that was considered collateral for our staff. If, in fact, they were deported, that wasn't our issue to deal with. That was a collateral issue. Well, the Supreme Court of the United States says differently in the Padilla case, Padilla versus Kentucky. Now, when a client comes in, we need and must screen the client for immigration issues, whether you know they're here legally, whether they have a working visa, whether they have a green card, all these issues that my lawyers are simply not equipped to deal with. They never were trained on it. They still aren't trained on it. And the federal court also said it's not good enough just to tell the client, go see a lawyer who does immigration work. We have to screen. We have to advise. And when the plea goes into court, there has to be that information provided in front of the judge who takes the plea. That substantially changes the way we've done our jobs. The other cases that change the way we do our jobs, I hope not dramatically, but certainly the time in which we handle these cases, is Frye and Lafler. It used to be that, I shouldn't say it this way. The bottom line is you are guaranteed effective assistance of counsel on plea negotiation. You can imagine in a lot of these courtrooms in the 87 counties in this state where it really is McJustice. It is, here's your deal. Do you want it today? If you don't, move along. If you don't take this offer today, it's going to be off the table. You've got 15 minutes to think it through. Well, if we continue to do that, the United States Supreme Court says that's not effective assistance of counsel because you have to advise clients appropriately, which obviously parenthetically would mean that the lawyers need to read the police reports before making this offer to them and whether it's a good offer or not. That slows the system down, and again, it sounds kind of odd, but it puts a tremendous amount of stress on the lawyers who've got 20, 30, 40 people on the calendar that day. You know, those of you in private practice who have one or two cases in court, my lawyers have 25. I mean, think about that. They have 25 clients they have to deal with, and they have to deal within the parameters that the Supreme Court continues to set for us, and rightfully so. Other areas have changed the way I practice and the lawyers in my office and other staff. Forensic issues, drug testing, I say the word St. Paul, I think all of you understand what I'm talking about. I wish it were true, and so many of us have done this, we would rely on the scientific, what we thought was scientific information provided to it, but what we thought were scientists. Well, guess what? We can't do that anymore, and we've seen how our office and the private bar failed miserably in some instances as to whether or not the stuff they're saying was drugs or not. Take that now to fingerprints, take that to tool mark, take that to shoe prints, take that to ear prints. Again, as a lawyer, I'll be honest with you, we would like to think that the evidence provided to us was real, was reliable, and actually scientific as it was purported to be. We've learned from scientists that we're relying on science that really isn't validated and really isn't science. So our ethical dilemma, it's not even a dilemma, our ethical rules are we must challenge that. You know, it's on us. It's the job of the defense lawyer to challenge this information. Technology, which I find incredibly fascinating in my district, every single case from the city of Minneapolis, every single charge, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, is tendered to us no longer by a piece of paper. For our lawyers to do their job, they must bring their laptops to court, because all the information, all the discovery, all the police reports is all tendered now electronically in court. That's how much our job has changed over time. Obviously, it means no paper, but it also means our staffing is different because I'm not just looking for lawyers anymore. I have to look for tech people. This stuff freezes up. I mean, I didn't realize I'd be running this thing, and you know, I start pressing the button, all of a sudden it starts doing this stuff. You know, I mean, you got to know what you're doing, and if you're in court, you can't expect that the lawyer is going to be the person who's always going to control these issues. They can't be. The last thing, if I can, real quickly, expert witnesses. And I'm very lucky. In some ways, the Hennepin County Commissioners would say I'm very unlucky, but I get Hennepin County money every single year as part of my budget. It's been an ongoing frustration for more than you can possibly imagine. But part of my budget, aside from this body and this and the state board, is from Hennepin County. Why that makes me lucky is when I need an expert witness, I talk to the lawyers in my office. I review with them what I need it for. If we believe it's something that's needed, we'll go forward and ask the person to assist us. In literally just about every other of the 86 counties, when their little expert expenditure runs out, they have to apply to the court for money for every single item I'm talking about, including transcripts, including interpreters, including experts to look at the DNA stuff, on and on and on. And that's changing the way we do our practice based upon the fact we can't rely on the science. So my, again, portion here, I'm telling you, we've got people, we're lucky they stick around based upon what we're asking them to do, based upon their remuneration. But we've got to figure out a way of not just getting them remunerated, but figuring out a great way to make sure that we're doing our job so these cases don't keep coming back to the appellate office in, of the state board.
We have some questions. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can any of you tell me, based upon your current applications, would legislators qualify for a public defender?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Port.
Representative Lush, I know you're doing this tongue-in-cheek. We've had this discussion in the past before. No, you wouldn't be eligible. And we do represent the indigent folks in this state. I have zero concern in Hennepin County about my my clients. It is not an issue. When it is an issue, we bring it to the court's attention. And I've, in the 4 years I've been in the fourth, I brought it to the attention of the court on two occasions.
Okay.
Representative Lash.
Madam Chair, you're reading into my comments a little bit. I wasn't doing it to say, hey, you got to screen your clients better, although I do believe that's somewhat still the case. But it's important for members around this table to understand and know the costs associated with who goes through the system. I think we're still sitting at 80% of the cases statewide go through are represented by a public defender. So members, this is the vast majority of the justice dispensed throughout the state is done through the public defender system, and we need to make sure that an adequate job is being done on it. And that's for the reasons that especially you that make 31 whatever it is base salary plus however much you take in per diem, which isn't going to be more than 8 or 9. Can you afford to drop $4,000 if you get popped for a DWI? The answer for most of you is probably going to be no. And so the answer for a lot of other people is going to be no as well, so they default to the public defender. So there you have it. That's all, Madam Chair.
Other questions? I have a couple. And I'm not sure if you're going to get to it in your presentation. But Mr. Ward, right, you mentioned transcripts and interpreters. So are you going to talk about the transcript portion of your budget as well as interpreters in your presentation? Or
Madam Chair, we weren't going to, but we certainly can answer the what questions we can about. There's a couple of different issues on transcripts. I'm not quite sure which one you're.
Sure. So Mr. Kyer, it's my understanding that the public defender's office always runs out of money for transcripts. Is that a accurate representation, Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair, in the 20-some years I've been doing this business, every year.
And Mr. Kyer, about what point in time in the year do you typically run out of money for transcripts, Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair and members, let me address that and just kind of give you what happens within the biennium, because we do budget by fiscal year, but you all provide a biennial budget. Typically, we have about $300,000 a year set aside for transcripts in our appellate office. Depending on the year, we will expend that usually by about January, somewhere in there, January, February. This year it happened to be October. So the first year of the biennium, generally about January or February, we do have a statutorily mandated emergency fund that we use for high-profile conflict cases, things like that, where we can also use for transcripts. Typically, we set aside another probably $200,000 to $250,000 for transcript costs. We then pay that out. After that, if there are still transcripts to be paid during that year, we will hold them until the 1st of July when we get the next budget allocation, which then puts us obviously behind for that fiscal year. We will then start that process all over again. Typically, we run out of money in the fall or in the winter, and then we start again, and When we get down to the spring, if it looks like there's money available because we've had people leave or whatever, we will try to shift money into the transcript budget. Typically, we spend, I've got it here somewhere, right now we probably average somewhere around $700,000 a year in transcript costs in that office.
So, Mr. Kier, then you budget $300,000 and it costs about $700,000. So is it actually the court reporter who is waiting on that money, or is it the court that is waiting on you paying the money? Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and members, that's the court reporter who is obligated to provide that transcript of that trial or that court session.
Okay. And then interpreters, Mr. Kier, so what portion of your budget is set aside for interpreters, and do you typically have the interpreters only available at court time, or do you set aside time where the interpreter and the lawyer and the client have the opportunity to talk away from the court to go through police reports and things of that nature? Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and members, we have, again, you heard from Mr. Ward, so I'm going to say exclusive of Hennepin County, because again, they have a little different funding mix. We have roughly, want to say, about $200,000 a year set aside for expert witness and interpreters. They're mixed in the same line item. I can't tell you exactly how it's broken out. I mean, we could go through expenditure by expenditure and find it. The vast majority of that is for expert witnesses. Typically, the court who has the interpreters for the courtroom has been generous that they've allowed our folks to use them in court and generally right before and right after court. If we need to have an interpreter outside of that time frame, you're meeting somebody in the jail, you're meeting them in the office, there's a witness that has to be interviewed, that's typically something then we have to pay for.
So, Mr. Kier, so about, do you run out of money for interpreters at some point in time in the year? And if so, about what point in time do you run out of money? Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair, again, because of the mix of expert witnesses and interpreters, we typically run out of that funding. It varies, but usually, around the first of the year, something like that. Maybe sometimes it gets a little further. Again, on the experts, it really depends on what the caseload ends up being. I can tell you we do expend almost all of it every year, but it does vary.
Ms. Fuller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like you to know that in rural Minnesota, it's not very easy to get interpreters, and we have to pay travel and mileage when we have to use them outside of the courts. So we do try to be creative. We Skype with interpreters. We do Facebook with interpreters. Sometimes we do a telephone relay with interpreters. AT&T will provide a telephone relay. And so we understand our obligations with the money that is given. We try to use them around the court. There's usually a half an hour window that the court will grant us either side of the court proceeding to work with the court interpreter. But outside of the court appearance, if we have to do it on our own, because it is limited, the money that we have, we do try to be creative and to use them in a way that is cost effective.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, please continue, Mr.
Madam Chair, on page 23 starts the actual budget recommendation, budget process. On page 23, I wanted to have you take a look at what the governor's recommendation is before we go to what our request was. You can see the governor's recommendation. On the red line, you can see the attorney registration fee. As we talked about in the overview in January, we do receive about $1.9 million a year in attorney registration fee funding. Every lawyer in the state pays $75 that goes towards public defense. That funding is scheduled to end June 30th of this year. This has been now the third biennium, I guess, or second biennium that the court has granted that $75. So when you look at the governor's recommendation, and include the potential loss of that attorney registration fee, the bottom numbers there are really what we're talking about in terms of where his recommendation is.
Representative Hammer, did you have a question?
On the registration fee?
Yes, Representative Paymar. Please use the microphone, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Kier, so how come you threw in the towel on this one?
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, we went to the General Assembly of the State Bar Association to get their support for that. Their support was instrumental in the last two times that we went to get the court approval for the $75. The General Assembly in December voted not to support that request, but to basically throw it back to you all and to the governor to try to figure this out in terms of that $1.9 million. Given the difficulty we had with the court in getting that $75 approved the last time, or the last two times, I should say, we didn't think it was prudent to go back to the court without Bar Association support and potentially lose a vote there, as opposed to, you know, going through with the process here. So,
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, so without the State Bar's approval, you don't feel like you can go forward, even if the court said that they're willing to, even if the court was willing to say that they would assess this on its own merit?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymer, I don't know that the court's ever said they'd be willing to go ahead and do that with either with or without Bar Association support. I will tell you it was a difficult task the last two times around.
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is, you know, for you as the chair of the committee, but it seems to me the court saying something different to some members of this committee about this, and if it's absolute that we need the stamp of the approval by the bar, that's one thing. But if the court can approve this without the approval of the bar, why wouldn't you go for it?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymer, I guess for the reasons that I articulated, which is we had the Bar Association support last time. We had the president of the bar testify in favor of this provision the last two times. And I believe the first vote was a 4-3 vote in favor of the $75, with one of the justices saying, yes, he would vote for it the first time, but he wasn't going to vote for it again. So it was a matter of taking a look at it and seeing where we were at. So,
well, Madam Chair, I just...
Representative Paymer.
I just don't understand why you wouldn't try. Because, I mean, you know, you're just sort of, not blaming you, but you're sort of passing the buck back to the legislature, and, you know, you've got a $2 million hole coming up here, and, you know, we don't know what's going to happen at the end of the day with our budget, and I think a lot of us would like to see more revenue for the Public Defense Board, but if you're not going to try, it leaves us wondering.
Mr. Kier, Mr. Stewart, I see that Mr. Stewart came to the table.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymer, the petition for the $75 was pulled, and the board, our board, did vote to pull that. I don't know that that's the final word on that, and I guess we're going to have to reassess, and they're going to have to reassess where we go from here, depending on obviously what you all do, and you know obviously what the governor's going to weigh in on. I will say that if you recall, going back to 2009, the original issue with this was that there were two budget cuts, general fund budget cuts, that went into effect on public defense, and then this $75 attorney registration fee was used as kind of, you know, to help out there and to mitigate that, and we were extremely grateful for that. I'm not sure it's realistic to expect that you have this very narrow group of people supporting, and this is the Bar Association talking now, this narrow group of people, in this case the 17 or 18,000 lawyers in the state, supporting what should be a general fund obligation of the state, which is a constitutional responsibility. Now, that's their argument.
Madam Chair, I won't belabor this, but you know, in a perfect world, I would say that's you're absolutely right. But this place isn't perfect, and we're going to have some major obstacles finding funding. And I'll just leave it there.
Well, Representative Paymer, let me just say that I originally had a bill back before this was done through the court to actually put the attorney registration fee on via statute, and was specifically asked not to put it in the statute. by then Justice Magnuson. And so I think we will continue to have discussions, but I think they have another opportunity between now and the time that this expires to submit and request this funding. And so I will be continuing to have this.
I hope you do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Paymer. No,
Madam Chair, if we would continue, page 24 is the first of three budget requests. As you all are doing in terms of struggling with and trying to put the state budget on some stable footing going into the future, what we are looking at is the same situation relative to public defense. Those of you around the table who have been here for any length of time know what kind of roller coaster we have been on over the last several years in terms of funding and staffing and all of those things, and I think we've kind of laid that out for you. Our plan is a three-biennium plan to reach 75% of those caseload standards that we referenced earlier. Right now, as we said, we're at roughly 58%. We would like to get to 75% over the next three bienniums. Again, would we like to get to 100%? Obviously. But you all don't have that kind of money, and frankly, I'm not sure we have the capacity to absorb those kind of numbers, although we'd like to try. The request asks for 33 new attorney positions the first year and an additional 20 the second year. It includes funding for salary increases and personnel increases, insurance cost increases over the next two-year period. Again, one of the issues that we deal with are how do we compensate our folks to be able to get them to stay under kind of these, what you've heard is these excruciating workloads and caseloads. An amount for investigators and paralegals and our dispositional advisors, again, to maintain those staffing levels as we add attorneys and to get them to that 75% level.
Mr. Kier, what is the pay increase rate that you're asking for your staff?
Madam Chair and members, we're asking for 3% each year. Now, again, those are obviously subject to contract negotiations that we have with our two employee groups. But we've got to have the money somewhere in order to pay those.
Please continue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski has a question. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on that basis, as a follow-up to that, what is the average salary and total compensation for your lawyers?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, right now we start our lawyers at roughly $54,000 a year. Takes them 19 years to get to the top of the pay scale, which is $98,000 a year, a little bit more than that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the total compensation, Mr. Kier, and with that, how is the health care premium handled? Do those employees pay a portion of the health care premium or not?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, if you look at the total, if somebody starts out with us at $54,000, if they have family insurance coverage, the total cost or the total compensation is probably about $83,000 at that level, again, if they have family coverage. All of the insurance is the same insurance that you all get that are sitting around this table through the state insurance program.
Thank you. All right. Please continue.
Madam Chair, that's the first request that we have, and that was on page 24. On page 26 is the request for making up the attorney registration fee funding. I think we've discussed that one quite a bit. It supports about 23 to 25 full-time equivalents lawyers, about 6% of our staff right now.
Can I ask another question? So if we go back to the last slide that you did, and the you want to add the 33 FTEs and the 20 additional. How much of the governor's budget proposal actually is funded of this plan? Does this reflect the governor's recommendation, or is this above the governor's recommendation? Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and members, the $4.6 million and the $9 million is what our request was. Of that, the governor chose to fund that $2.8 million and $5.7 million. So a little more than half the first year, well, actually a little more than half both years. So.
So is that half of the lawyers, half of the salary, half of the insurance, half of the entire package, or half of Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair and members, there was one line in the budget that said it was for compensation increases, for insurance costs, and for trying to start working on caseload relief, and a small amount for the Public Defense Corporation. So there really wasn't any designation outside of those, you know, those four items. But it was basically one line in the budget. So,
thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair, the third request is one for our technology staffing. As I mentioned earlier, we have five people in the office that do this, do all of our work, including all the programming, all of the troubleshooting. Mr. Ward talked about the technology issues earlier. It's woefully inadequate. If you look at that chart, our current end users to staff is about 150. We're proposing to get it down into that 50 area. Right now, an industry standard from what we've seen is about 20. Again, we don't want to get to the industry standard. We know that that's unrealistic. But we also know that when Chris Kohler in the 9th District or some of our folks in the other districts have these issues, we don't have the staff to help them out with this, and this is going to be more and more of an issue as we continue to move forward on more electronic disclosure. We've talked a little bit about that the last time we were here, on more and more of people using laptops and people using iPads. Right now, about half of our staff is part-time, as we talked about. We provide nothing to them in the way of technical support. We don't provide them with the computer. We don't provide them with the internet service. We don't provide them with any kind of troubleshooting if they have problems. When the court goes to an all-electronic system, we're going to have to deal with that. And that's not a negative. It's a positive, and it's going to be a positive. It's just something we've got to deal with. So,
members, just so you know, I have asked the public defenders to see if they could get me some information about the cost of technology, and as the court moves over, the court is only funding their side of the e-discovery and e-filing, and it doesn't take into account the public defender's costs, and so I've asked the public defenders to see if they can get us some of that information. Mr. Kaya, can you give us a timeline of if you think you're going to be able to get us any information about technology?
Madam Chair, we've got a couple of folks working on that now, so I'm hoping by the end of the week, if not the first part of next week.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that's the end of our presentation, and obviously we'll stand for any questions that you may have or members of the committee may have.
Members, I also wanted to let you know that the first three rows are lawyers from the 4th District Office, and so in addition to asking questions of our testifiers, if we have questions for folks who do this, they are here. So, Mr. Kyer, any members? Questions for members? Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Our research department got us a listing of the amounts collected from defendants, and I was just kind of startled by the difference there. For instance, in 2012, Anoka County, which is, I'm a resident of that, they only recovered $605 from defendants, while a county like Blue Earth recovered $13,959. And I'm wondering if you could maybe explain the differences there and why such a large county like Anoka doesn't recover more than a smaller county.
Mr. Kyer. No,
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, it is a cultural issue relative to the bench. And this has a long, long history. You should all know that when we get these public defender reimbursements, they don't come to us. These are passed through to our part-time defenders to offset the cost of their overhead. So a lot of this has to do with culture of the bench. A lot of it has to do, frankly, with the fact that a lot of those districts have part-time defenders. And so those are the folks that the judges see in the courtroom every day. So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And whose responsibility is it to collect these fees?
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, the court collects this just like they collect restitution, they collect fine and fee revenue, law library fees, whatever. This is about, I think, number 8 or 9 on the list of priorities in terms of collections.
Representative Scott.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe you can answer this question since you work in Anoka County. I'm just curious. You smiled kind of like you heard this, you've had this discussion before with somebody, but what is the issue that in Anoka County? Why is this such a low priority? I mean, I know it's a big county. They ought to be able to collect more than $600 a year.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Kyer, but the court has to order the reimbursement. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes.
So the court has to order, Representative Scott, the public defender reimbursement fee, and then it can be collected. Representative Scott.
And so why wouldn't they order that?
Representative Scott, I don't think I'm the right person to ask that question of. I don't know the answer to that. Representative Scott.
And Madam Chair, who would be the right person?
Because
all of us need to have the copy of this chart. Hennepin County, it's like $300.
And I happen to be, I used to be the chief of the 10th and Hennepin County. When I was the chief there, the goal was not to have the cases appointed to us. So if, in fact, the client wasn't eligible, my job in doing brown bag lunches with the court is don't appoint us and then have the client reimburse the court or reimburse public defense. Don't appoint us in the first place. So we spent a lot of time speaking to all the members of the bench in the 8 counties in the 10th district and changing the behavior of the easy appoint the public defender even though they're not eligible and then have them reimburse the public defender's office. I made it a mission to make sure that we were pointed on cases that clients were clearly eligible on, and that's the reason why the reduction in public defender reimbursement money reduced over the time I was there and continues to be at a low level. In Hennepin County, our clients are completely indigent people. We have folks who literally, the bench sets bail at $50 and they cannot get out of jail. It costs $125 a day for them to stay there. $50, they can't post it. So Hennepin County public defender reimbursement is not an issue, and it shouldn't be an issue in that county at all.
But, and it's also with the copay, the public defender copay. So there are two different types. There's reimbursement, and that's when they get a lawyer when they're not entitled. And then there's the copay, which is also in statute. And so do you want to,
well, Madam Chair,
let me talk about those two pieces?
Let me just address that just briefly. Is the $75 copayment, which goes to the general fund, it can be assessed on all cases. And it is waived. It's waivable. It has to be waivable by constitution. You have to be able to do that. I would just correct you a little bit, Madam Chair, is that these aren't necessarily cases we wouldn't get anyway. Some of them, maybe, but they're ones where folks can't afford to pay something or may be able to afford something, but they can't afford to go out and hire a private lawyer. I think Representative Lesh mentioned before, if you were accused of a DWI, who's got the $4,000 up front cash to give to a private lawyer? I will tell you that's probably low. If you're accused of a felony, a crim sex case, I don't know a lawyer that's not going to take $10,000 or $15,000 up front before they start that. Once the clock starts running, and I think I've mentioned this the last time I was here, I had some legal work done for a member of the family a year ago. It was $175 an hour, and that was a friend break. Those of you who have had legal work done know that that's probably pretty cheap. So it isn't necessarily folks that aren't eligible or would not be eligible, but folks that do you want to really have them go out, try to find a private lawyer, then after 2 or 3 weeks come back and say, well, gee, I couldn't find anybody, now you've lost 2 or 3 weeks, you know, where you could have settled that case. So it's a mix.
Representative Scott, follow up?
I think I'll be contacting my county commissioners and have a conversation. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Good luck with your county commissioners. Judges who sit on the bench don't necessarily listen to them that much, but absolutely a cultural thing for the judges in the jurisdiction you sit. I know in Ramsey County, obviously our numbers is almost as low as Minneapolis, and as we were just discussing over here, they routinely, I one in 50 do they ever not waive the public defender fee. Maybe that's exaggerating, but 6 in 50. Regardless, I wonder, my question is, yes, if any of the public defenders could speak to a question, are there any of Mr. Kier who have been practicing as a public defender for less than 4 years that are here with us?
Mr. Kier. Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I tell the truth, I don't know if we've got any. No. Yeah. What? Yeah.
Chris Butler.
Yep.
Could that person come up?
Representative Lesh.
Uh-oh. It's nothing to be afraid of. I'm not going to go.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Christian Butler. I'm a public defender in the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County.
Thank you. Representative Lesh, your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Butler, how were you trained in, Mr. Butler, for your job?
Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We went through a roughly 3-week training process, and it was my understanding that it was more or less a new program being implemented when I was hired just a little over a year ago now. But it is also my understanding that that training program will continue on because it definitely was extremely useful.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Mr. Butler, were you in the courtroom at the time with another attorney when you were trained that way?
Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, when I first started, I did shadow a veteran attorney.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I asked the question, Mr. Butler, is I know my experiences in Ramsey County is they don't even have the staff to adequately train folks in. It sounds like you had a pretty good training experience, which is good, but a lot of times the public defenders in Ramsey County get thrown into the deep end of the swimming hole. And it's no fault of their own, but it's kind of difficult because when you're in custody arraignments in the morning and you've got folks yelling at you, and I see them walk back out of the holding cells and they're just like deer in the headlights, what just happened? And then I walk through what I can offer. I'm assuming you talk with other public defenders in other jurisdictions. Do you feel that they have a better or worse training opportunity than you had?
Mr. Butler.
Honestly, I have no idea with respect to other jurisdictions' training program, but I would like to briefly respond to your comments earlier, if I may. I do consider myself lucky and the other attorneys in my office lucky with respect to our training program, but that's only because of the other attorneys who are in our office giving up their time to have the new attorney shadow them. I did shadow more than one attorney. And again, I am with the misdemeanor division in my office. So I've been with that division since I started just a little over a year ago. But I had other attorneys with the misdemeanor division as well as the felony division, allowing me and the other new hires at that time to shadow them. So it was definitely a group effort. So we are lucky, but I wouldn't say it's because we just have all of this manpower that we're able to do it by any means, no.
And in fact, Madam Chair, if I can respond to that.
Mr. Ward.
We are still short-staffed, over double digits in lawyers in the 4th District. And we did make a determined effort to change our training in our office with the hires of Mr. Butler and a number of other people at the same time. In order for that to be successful, I hired more than 10 lawyers at that time. And that's how short-staffed we were. And I'm still 12 lawyers short. We did it in such a way that we brought them in at the same time to have I hate to call it a class, but to have more people there, to have it better organized, to make sure we can get people set up with mentors and shadowing and in-house training. But it's a rarity that we are able to do that. We hope to do it in the future. That's our goal. And it's been, obviously, with Mr. Butler's success and the others in this office, it's been very helpful because of the staffing in our office.
Madam Chair, can I answer the question from a rural perspective?
Certainly. Ms. Kohler.
I can tell you that outstate Minnesota does not have the type of training program that Hennepin County does for its new lawyers. It is primarily done on a shadowing basis. And again, as I testified earlier, in many occasions, the supervisors, the managers, the trainers, once the limited training is done, are 120 miles away or 60 or 70 miles away. So when they get bombarded in the courtroom, they're the only lawyer there, they're by themselves, and their nearest support person is 60 to 70 miles away. So we don't have the luxury that Hennepin County does, where they can have a training class and hire 10 lawyers and send them through at one time. I hire one lawyer at a time, and they may be supervised by a supervisor 60 to 70 miles away.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, every jurisdiction is different, but I can tell you I've trained in quite a few new public defenders, and it's just because that's with a better administration of justice. Absolutely. I try to be objective. I make clear to them that and they know obviously I'm the prosecutor, but there are certain I's that can be dotted and T's that can be crossed that need to happen in order for, because they're on the spot right then. They need to represent their client as best they can, but it impacts the rest of the court system when they're not adequately trained, because the judge wants to stop, the court reporter is there, the other court staff is there, and I'm there. So a good training program is really worthwhile if you can do it, but I understand you're short staff.
Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kohler, you talked about the trips to the moon and back. I'm wondering what the use of the IT ITV system, especially for those first visits, have all the districts been using those, and how can your agency use those more?
Ms. Kohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We've been the pilot program for ITV back since 1996. All 17 counties in northwestern Minnesota do use ITV and have it installed in all of their courtrooms. And the last, I was on a Supreme Court committee about ITV, and I think at this point somewhere between 64 to 67 of the counties are wired for ITV use. I think in some of the rural areas, the judges frequently appear in courthouses where there isn't a sitting judge, and that's how ITV is being used, so the judge doesn't travel. I've had several instances where it's been the request of the public defender to use ITV and to avoid public defender travel, and we have received considerable opposition from the bench and from the prosecutor's office toward any other use of ITV other than judges appearing for calendars in counties where there isn't a seated judge available.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kohler, for those of us that aren't in the courtroom daily or at all, can you kind of elaborate on that opposition from and who makes those rules and how that works?
Ms. Kohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The rules regarding ITV were promulgated by the Supreme Court, and at this point, in order for you to use ITV other than the judge appear, it has to have the consent of all parties. So if we suggest the use of ITV and either the prosecutor or the judge objects, we cannot use it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Kohler. Mr. Kier, the 2010 OLA audit, and I know you and I talked a little bit about that earlier, but can you review for us kind of where you're at on one of the points in the audit is that they suggested that you need to indicate standards for determining the eligibility for public defenders better and more clearly defined in state law. Where are we at in that, and what have we or have we not done? What do we have to do yet in that area?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, the audit report talked about a more firm eligibility standard. You are the ones that determine what the standard ought to be. The courts are the ones that enforce whatever eligibility standard there is. 2 years ago, we came with a bill to put, basically implement the auditor's recommendation in terms of putting in graduated numerical standards, if you will, percentage standards. This body passed it, the Senate passed it, the governor vetoed that bill 2 years ago. Last year, we came back with a modified version of that, which was less, didn't have the numerical standards in, tightened up some of the eligibility, put in that you'd have a standard form to be used. That was eventually passed and signed by the governor.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that?
Ms. Kohler.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, I have 17 counties in my judicial district. The last I checked, there are 7 different eligibility forms used by the courts. Even though the law requires 1 standard eligibility form to be used throughout the state, there are 7 different forms being used in my district alone. And it's not the public defender's office that tells
the courts which forms to use. It's the judges and it's the court administrators. So even though there is a standard eligibility form out there, the judges have their own particular forms that they'd like to use, and that's what they use.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Kohler. And I understand the judges are asking for a salary increase.
Further questions from members? All right, is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to make any comments about the testimony that you've heard today? All right, hearing none, this meeting is adjourned.